it's a great letter being introduced by my former and now very successful PI young researcher Dario, and of course very delighted to be here. Thank you.
And I hope to repeat the experience in the near future more often. What I'll be giving you today is what I've called an orthogonal view on asymptotic safety from the standpoint of causal dynamical applied relations, which is a causation program for gravity I've been involved for the last 10 years, I'm afraid to say, already. But of course, 10 years, 10 years is just
a blip from gravity. Now, I'm also happy to tell you that the effort in four space-time dimensions, which is of course a physically relevant one, is no longer a one woman and two men show, and in the sense that it's not just my good old collaborator Stan Ambjörn and Richard Kirkich involved there, but also a couple of very talented graduate students, Andrei Görlich of Krakow and Tom Jordan in Utrecht, who've been involved in the numerical as well as political work there. Okay, let me start with a bang. So this is a future of quantum gravity, which I suppose most of the audience assembled here would subscribe to in one way or other. What does it say? The framework of standard quantum field theory is sufficient to construct and understand quantum gravity as a fundamental theory if the dynamical and non-perturbative state of space-time is taken into account properly. Now, my own little flavor on this is that I'd like to insert a little causal up here. Now, I'm not entirely sure because I wasn't around. I was wondering whether 30 years ago this kind of thesis would have sounded quite as radical in its minimalism as it does today. Otto Koffen has to say that it's already implied a little bit what I'm writing here is through Fox, that at any event, one is pushing the boundaries of standard here, because after all, of course, we're talking about gravity already classically. That is, looks rather different from the other field theories. Now, not just people present at this conference working on renal normalization group methods and things I might be doing would subscribe to see like this, but of course, there are also other non-perturbative approaches of gravity that would. Would back the sort of state, possibly small modification in the formulation. But of course, just because it's not string theory, it doesn't mean that these approaches will be all the same in some way or equivalent. Now, one of the possible scenarios we've been focusing about is of what might happen in the UV, which of course is the region that interests us. For quantum gravity primarily is asymptotic safety. And well, establishing a fixed point would, in my view, certainly be a great advance. But of course, one has to keep in the back of one's mind that even, say, with functional renormalization group methods or other methods, when we're able to establish the existence of a non-dual fixed point, well, the real work would still lie ahead, in the sense that one would still have to work, or we would still have to work out the physical implications of this. Another, of course, question that has already been brought up in yesterday's talk is this asymptotic safety scenario, is it inescapable in some way? Are other unique completions imaginable, thinkable? Well, I should certainly think on general grounds that should be the case. Because certainly, in whatever method we are using to try and study quantum gravity UV, you're always making some kind of assumption that certain part of our description, the variables they're using, the tools they're using, the concepts they're using, they remain to some extent meaningful and usable as we approach the back scale. And that is something that might be very difficult to check. It might be also very difficult to check within any given one approach. So I like also to raise a slightly provocative question of is the existence of a monetary fix, but actually a physical observable gravity. Now, I believe the best we can do currently to answer also, well, this question and questions concerning observable, possible observable
quantum gravity is to rely on what I'm calling a web of quantum gravities, alluding to other webs that are around, more or less successfully. By this, I mean also to imply that, well, some of those might be right, some of them might turn out to be wrong. It's, for many of them, it's too early to tell, but of course there have been many non-determinant approaches going on for several decades now. Some of them are more loosely defined, and some of them are more stringently defined. Now, the road forward in trying to understand this better, the entire problem of quantum gravity better, in my view, is not just in mine, is to concentrate on trying to find observables. So by observables, observables, you know, in quotes here, I mean invariably defined geometric quantities, so that are, say, when it's in continuum, for example, are for all invariant. Now, these kind of objects, among other things, are very handy to compare the different gravities in the world of quantum gravity. And a beautiful example we've been seeing of this recently
is exactly this result of short distance spectral dimension, which is found across a number of rather disparate approaches to have an anomalous value of 2 in the DPV, whereas it is 4, of course, on large scale. And I'm happy to say that most of the people who, in one way or other, prove results of this kind are in this room today, and I'm just have listed them here, I won't name them. The issue will presumably also come up later for. And, well, of course, one might be a cynic and say, well, this might be just accidental, certainly of approaches where one tries to kind of verify such a result with hindsight, knowing what all the other guys have been deriving. But on the other hand, taking a positive view on this, it might very well be that they tell us something deep, and of course, that would be a hope point. And what amongst other things he could tell us is also if he can derive these such a result in so different approaches that look so different, that may also tell us something about, well, what quantum gravity is, and that it might not be wise actually to compare and throw out certain approaches by comparing that at a level that is much below that of actual observables. And of course, here I've distinguished the observables in the inverted commas. They are really these invariantly defined geometric properties. If you want to get to real observables, so things you might actually go out and measure, is of course another step and a very difficult step of problem. So I think it's also useful to make that distinction. Now, getting a little more back to the primary theme of this workshop. Now, how might we envisage testing for something like asymptotic safety? Now, most of what we have already been hearing here about at this meeting are these very powerful functional renormalization group methods, which are tailor-made to address the problem. What I want to point out today is that there might also be our, and in many senses, kind of orthogonal method, like that of fault dynamic regulations, from which you might perhaps get further information of this issue. And if one did, I think that would be that would add a lot of value to this conjecture. Now, I'm setting the two approaches next to each other just to first set the stage a little bit to. I discussed what they have in common, in what ways they're different. Now, first of all, what they have in common, they are covariant, action-based approaches. Note, I'm not saying nothing people here. Just a concession, right? And the full dynamics of the series, so all the degrees of freedom, are also incorporated. So it's not it's not toy models like cosmology. There are no patients involved here apart from the regularization convention. Now, as a vital input to derive the results that have been arrived at, one uses numerical tools. Now, they're quite different in the two approaches, but well, there you go. It's true that is a vital element. In both of them, one can look for scaling behavior in the EDV, which is also very important for addressing these issues of asymptotic safety. And then I would say they are somewhat singled out, maybe, with regard to other approaches, in being conceptually and computationally one of type. But of course, goes hand in hand with using very standard methods to try and make progress on this long-standing problem. They also don't appeal to any exotic ingredients or symmetries. And of course, that might actually raise the hope that they may be falsifiable. Now, I'm not one to talk about falsifiability of the renormalization group expired results, but for the dynamical triangulations, at least one can point to something, namely the Euclidean version of that, the Euclidean attempt to come up with a theory of probability that has already been falsified in this code. I'll get back a bit later. So there's certainly a hope that this is sufficiently tried, and that's of course something that is increasingly rare. Now, the difference between the two approaches, also here just schematically put for you on the sheet. Now, the FRG approach is really algebraic in nature. So you have this momentum space, the running of the renormalization group of your coupling constant, where a CDT is very geometric. And therefore, it's often easier to relate to kind of classical geometric concept there. FRG is essentially a continuum formulation, the way it's been used, whereas CDT makes use of a discretization of not of space time itself, but of the metric freedom on space time. On the left hand side here, you need gauge fixing that just comes with a continuum formulation. It's kind of inevitable, but here on the right hand side, you have no gauge freedom left, so you're really working on the quotient space. Now, also an important difference that raises actually a question to people working on the FRG approach is this is just a Euclidean formulation, whereas in the CDT approach, as I'll also be pointing out later on, causal structure seems to be absolutely essential. So there are clearly some mismatches here, and well, where one try and might try and learn things. Yeah. Yeah, it might be, you know, I go on to be more specific about the construction of ingredients, and you'll see. Of course, I start out in a Lorentzian formulation. That's in a nutshell the thing. I have something like a recrotation, inverted commas, which I apply, then I do my full calculation in the Euclidean regime. That's the only way I know how to do it. And then I still have to rotate back in order to get to the Lorentzian regime. And that's, of course, a non-trivial step in general. There might be all kinds of subtleties, but there's, I mean, if one does it the way we do it, there is almost nothing else is possible. So like relaxing the foliation or something that it's not a whole different discussion itself, but it doesn't seem possible in any easy one. Which might tell you something deeper. I don't know. It's a longish discussion. Okay. Now, before, however, going into the details of the construction, just to motivate you staying awake for the remainder of this talk, what is this CDT quantum gravity good for? What might it be able to do for you? Well, given a model of kind of full non-perturbative quantum gravity, consisting of a choice of microscopic ingredient trading, a dynamical principle, and maybe extra ingredients, unfortunately, we typically are unable to work out in an immediate way its dynamics or determinative predictions in an analytic manner. So you have something sitting, you know, and it's written down in pen and pencil, but you don't really understand what its consequences are, which is, of course, bad if you want to determine whether it has anything to do with this physics. Now, the technical toolbox that comes with this approach of force dynamic manipulations are essentially Monte Carlo simulations and an associated kind of finite size scaling analysis allows us to do this. So, although we are not able to understand the details of how this works, you're putting into the system certain microscopic degrees of freedom with very few other assumptions, and you kind of let the quantum interact, and you can look with the help of the computer what comes out of our state. Now, and in this way, you can also obtain information that doesn't seem to be easily available with any other method. And in that regard, it's actually quite closely related to what led to see the dots in quantum dynamics. Now, of course, one should also not forget, I mean, this is not just a method, but it might potentially lead us to the correct theory of quantum gravity itself, but a non-trivial limiting process is part of this whole story, and this needs to be shown to exist in order for sensible UV fundamental theory to emerge. Now, another thing that we try to do, and we have been able to some limited extent, is to evaluate suitable diffeomorphism invariant quantities. These were my observables from earlier on. And some of these already give us hints of how one might be able to construct an effective theory of what we see on very, very short scales, but that is far from the story. As we'll see, with the progress we've been making up to now, we have already uncovered quite a number of non-perturbative surprises, some of them I'll be describing to you today. Now, some of the more technical aspects I have to cover a little bit, because although some of you may be very familiar with that, a part of your audience certainly is not. So let me just briefly say some things about the beautiful geometric idea that lies behind this entire approach, and which we are not the first people to make use of. And the beautiful idea goes back to, in physics, to Toulouse-Lautrec, 1961. It is that of describing general relativity without coordinates. So how do you go about this? You approximate curved spaces by simplicial approximation. Well, what's a symplex? A symplex is simply a triangle or a higher dimensional generalization thereof in higher dimensions. And it's, of course, very easy to imagine in two dimensions how you might approximate a curved, a nice 2D surface by, with the help of flat triangle. And, of course, such a triangular surface has also curvature, but they are kind of singular from a continuum point of view. So the curvature, say, in 2D is concentrated in vertical. But nevertheless, they give you very nice approximations that you can use in the classical theory. That's what it was invented for. It really is a discretization of the space of metrics, of geometry, if you like. So what was classically a pair of manifold M and comes through the sign of G mu of X, of course, modded out by the diffeomorphisms, I should say, is approximated by such a triangular expression called kappa of T, where all you have to give me in order to specify this uniquely is out of the edge level of all the triangles that go into it, and how they're glued together pairwise into a simplicial manifold. Now, so the entire, the full geometric information of curved geometry is encoded in these edge vectors and this connectivity of two. And, well, it works in any dimension. That's also another beautiful thing. Of course, E equals zero, the synthesis of the points, so it's not much interesting to talk about. Neither is there in one dimension where your synthesis are just one dimensional edges. In 2D, you have triangles. In 3D, you have tetrahedra. And, of course, what we'll be using in 4D are four dimensional synthesis. Now, these, of course, implicitly carry a metric. So once you give me all the edge values, and, well, fix the signature, what the signature of the metric is, a unique flat metric modulo diffeomorphism is defined on the interior. So its interior is, by definition, flat. So if you are in Minkowski, say, then you'll be able to tell where all the light rays go. So the geometry is completely fixed. If you want to, you can reintroduce coordinates on each individual synthesis and then move it together. But the beauty of the whole thing is that you needn't do that. So however, if you insist on doing that, and there are many, many different ways of doing it, here I'm illustrating one for you where, say, the coordinate system on a 2D triangle is just in this non-orthogonal way, based at one of the corners of the triangle, then you can write the two-dimensional method as a function of the three independent aspects of the triangle. So that is what it looks like explicitly. But really the beauty is that you don't have to do that. And in the quantum applications, where we'll be using the same kind of approximation for curved space-time, you don't do that either. Curvature in 2D is encoded in deficit angles and very analogous constructions holding higher dimensions, where then generally the curvature is concentrated in a delta function like fashion on the d-2 dimensional subsyntheses. So in four dimensions, it would be two-dimensional triangles where the curvature is kind of peaked. Okay, now, how does causally dynamically triangulated quantum gravity make use of this structure? We use this approximation in the sum over histories, in the path integral. Now, the path integral here I'm writing as kind of partition function notation Z, depending on the number of bare couplings, the Newton coupling and the cosmological lambda in this case. And what I'm doing, what is part of this prescription, is to give a definite meaning to this very ill-defined half integral over all geometries, which one writes down in the continuum like here on the left hand side, as an integral, for the functional integral over all matrix modular diffeomorphisms, so space-time geometries, if you like, where each one of them is weighed with an exponential rate e to the I gravitational action, say Einstein-Hilbert action. Now, the way this is represented in causal dynamical triangulations is as a sum over inequivalent triangulations, where your triangulations still depend on two regularization parameters. One of them is a short scale cutoff, little a, that essentially just gives you as a typical edge length of one of your building blocks, and a capital N, which simply gives you the number of building blocks that go into the construction at any finite volume n. And of course, what you then want to do in the end is to take in some well-defined manner a limit as a goes to zero and n goes to infinity to obtain what one might call a continuum theory. Here on the right-hand side, the Euclidean, the Einstein action is represented by the expression that Roger found for simplicial geometries, and the 1 over ct is kind of the only non-trivial part of the measure that appears here. C of t is the dimensionality of the automorphism group, so of the group of non-trivial symmetries of any given triangulation onto itself, which you're dividing out here. And you can show that this is a feature of the Wheeler-DeWitt measure in the continuum. So that does actually make sense. Here, the individual spaces, as we've already talked about, are represented, the smooth curved space-time in the path integral are represented here by these simplicial gluings of N syntheses. Okay, here's a picture of the building block we're using in four dimensions. And it's a kind of a Minkowskian thing to start with, so it has, well, in the way we implement it, some of the edges are time-like, all the ones that go up here, they're time-like, and they have a length squared of minus alpha a squared. A was our UV cutoff, alpha is an arbitrary positive constant, and you have space-like edges, which have, by that definition, a length squared equal to plus a squared. So you see, we have an arbitrary relative scaling because of kind of an asymmetry, kind of an anisotropy, if you like, in which we are setting this up, which is important in what follows. Now, small remark I've added down here, our use of these triangular building blocks in no way should prejudice us to think that real space can consist of little triangles, and that would be just something you pull out of the hat. So that's not what we believe is true. We just use this as an intermediate regularization, and in the continuum limit, as we shrink these individual building blocks to zero, nothing should depend on this particular choice. And that is, of course, something one still explicitly has to verify. Now, what are the key features of this approach? One works directly on the space of geometries that I've already mentioned. One can be non-determinative. Well, we can be because we are actually able to evaluate this discretized path integral in higher dimensions numerically to some extent. It contains metrics that are very, very far from the classical, any classical smooth object. It's background independent in the sense that you're not distinguishing any specific metric. So everything enters kind of democratically in this huge sum. We are able to evaluate this quantitatively to expect some results. The ingredients are fairly minimalist, so you don't have to believe in very many things, but to believe that this hopefully gives you something interesting. Now, in terms of results, which I'll come to in a second, I believe that this particular approach is the only one where you can see how dynamically, just from nothing but kind of quantum fluctuations of degrees of freedom on very small scales, you reach, you see emerging on large scale something that is actually a physically realistic background. That's a specific background, as you'll see in a minute. And what is quite nice, by virtue of this entire construction, the results are rather robust. And so many of the microscopic details of the regularization procedure are irrelevant. So that goes, of course, that is the big thing about universality. So to some degree, we have at least shown that this is the case. Now, let me come, without further ado, to kind of outline you some of the key achievements of this approach and what I believe are the important lessons we've learned from those. So the first one, which I have already mentioned in passing, is that within the class of models, one can study of which are dynamical models of quantum geometry, the CDT, or this dynamical triangulated approach, has given us very explicit models where you can see that it does make a difference of whether the metric has positive or indefinite signature. So whether your curve objects, your summing over the path integral, are Lorentzian kind of generic spacetime, or whether they are Euclidean, as is of course very often assumed in approaches of this kind. So to start with, in two dimensions, that was a very nice result we got early on, and in a way started the entire enterprise, was an explicit kind of two-dimensional model of Lorentzian quantum gravity. We could define it explicitly self-analytically, which showed that there is a genuine difference. So what are these models about? Well, they are really toy models, because of course in two dimensions you don't have the gravitonic local excitations. So all your quantizing there are kind of quantum, are quantum fluctuations, if you like. Now, what one can do is one can write down sums over geometries, and one can have these geometries have Euclidean signature, which essentially means you are not distinguishing between space and time at all. You're using Euclidean triangles, and you glue them whichever way you can into some visual manifold. And on the other hand, you can impose a light construction, you can impose a causal structure. And the only way we really know how to arrange for this is to have these triangulations have a kind of slice structure. So you have to introduce something that is a notion of proper time at this discretized level, and that at the same time kind of makes sure that no causality violations occur. Now, what precisely do I mean by causality violations? It's something, so here you see on the left-hand side is a two-dimensional Lorentzian path integral history. So this is a two-dimensional space-time where time goes vertically, and the spatial extension is just the length of a spatial universe, so the universe is one-dimensional here, which might oscillate or change as a function of time. And this is a purely Lorentzian path integral history that enters in the kind of CDT model defined there. And this is to be contrasted with what you could do in the Euclidean picture. Now, in the Euclidean picture, you just have two-dimensional space-time that are grouped in triangles. Now, you can just force on them a time slicing. You can just do that. Now, what then, however, typically happens, what you see happen is that well, your space, even if you start out with a spatial structure as a circle, it will split up into several components and possibly, you know, rejoin again as a function of this artificially imposed time. So the way you can think of the Lorentzian structure, as opposed to the Euclidean ones, is that these are things that are not allowed. You have a formulation where you do have a time, and with respect to that time, you're suppressing all these branches. And this is what turns out to make substantial difference. In the configuration space, you're integrating over the path. So that just leads to two entirely different continuum theories, which are time models of quantum geometry in two dimensions. Now, what should also be noted here, that something I'm not able to talk about, but which was already where people already raised the question about, we do have a well-defined Wick rotation, because it turns out we cannot do the sum of geometry in the Lorentzian regime. So we have to, just for technical reasons, we have to Wick rotate. But the Wick rotating Lorentzian path into the distance gives only a very small subset of Euclidean
path into the distance, which you would sum over if you started
in the Euclidean picture in the first place. So,
in foriated structures and Bosel structures, because I don't see how the Euclidean geometry on the right in your picture violates causality in any way. If you put in the preferred foliation that you indicated, there is no violation of causality. There's just a violation of the foliation structure.
No, it's only a causality violation if you interpret it in a long Lorentzian picture. And why is it violating? Because you have the singular, you have points. The way I've drawn it should suggest an embedding in a 3D space where time goes upwards.
But the complicated that geometry that on the right, it cannot be even Wick rotated back and interpreted individually as a geometry in Minkowski signature.
You mean this one here?
No, the one on the right, where you're claiming that there's a violation of causality at the red cross.
No, I'm just saying that if I insisted on introducing the time, as I have in the Lorentzian picture, and I insisted on interpreting this Euclidean thing with respect to that time, I would find these causality violating points. Why? Because these are points where the light cone degenerates, you see. So if this is time and this is space, then in these isolated points here, at the tips and at these branching points, just the light cone is not.
There are no light cones here, right? It's a Euclidean metric that you have.
No, I'm just saying if I insisted to put on a Lorentzian structure on such objects, then. Yeah. This is the statement I'm making. If I look at this purely within the Euclidean regime, there is no contradiction that arises anywhere. But from the point of view of trying to understand what is the difference between here and here, these two sets of geometries, I mean, this is the essential difference. And you exactly can pinpoint it like I'm doing here. Of course, we're not interested in 3D toy models, so then we, of course, eventually moved to higher dimensions and went especially to D=4. And again, they are very rewarding. You could show that encoding causality into the gluon rules already at this discretized level of the construction turns out to be essential for obtaining something, well, that is a good classical limit, or at least has a chance of having a good classical limit. Now, what is essential here to the gluon rules? As I said, it's implemented through a time slicing. What this eliminates are, well, also possible closed timeline curves, but also just points where the metric, if I insisted on having a Lorentzian smooth metric on these things, had isolated points where light cones just collapse, or even more general extended regions where the light cones collapse. Now, how did it turn out? How could we see that this was a very important requirement?
Well, people had been studying up to that point in the mid-90s very interesting precursors of these models, which were just defined as purely Euclidean signature. So they are inspired by the successes this method had in two dimensions. People looked for a possibility of making it in four dimensions, applying these sums over random geometries, triangulated geometries, to obtain, hopefully, a theory of quantum gravity. Now, only after some time, it did emerge that these superpositions of geometries do not give rise to interesting, apparently interesting extended spacelines. So So another way of saying it is there doesn't seem to be a good classical limit. There might be a continuum limit, but it's not certainly not a continuum limit that has anything to do with the theory of general relativity. And one thing you might do is, for instance, look at one of these dynamical elements, for example, the Hausdorff dimension, which tells you that there's something very deeply wrong with these Euclidean models. Instead, if I'm restricting the space bound by, again, eliminating the branchings also in higher dimensions, only the branchings in time direction, I should emphasize, not those in the spatial direction, they're also happily present there. So if by this, what I call introducing a condition of microcausality, so I put that into the parse integral and restricted the space time accordingly, all of a sudden things look entirely different. And one did actually for the first time find and extended a nice four-dimensional on large scales quantum universe. That work goes back some years by now. Now, amongst other things, what this reveals is a kind of very intriguing relation between kind of microscopic building gluing rules you're putting in there and some macroscopic requirement. So that's actually, I think, a rare instance. I haven't seen that in higher dimensional theories happen in that very explicit way. So really, and as I already said, the essential difference between the Euclidean and the Lorentzian is that of suppressing these baby universes that bound off the time direction. Now, if one wants to make this a little more quantitative and also understand how we do get to this kind of result, let me just flash kind of the phase diagrams of these two different ways of constructing the theory. So what one here emphasizes here is the character of that as, after Wickertaking, of certain statistical systems of objects, which are, happen to be a curved triangulated geometry. Now, if one then looks at the phase diagram, so the phase diagram just being spanned by the bare couplings that you put into these models in the first place, you obtain two completely different pictures when you do it in the Euclidean versus the Lorentzian theory. So I have to explain one abbreviation here is NI. This just counts the number of simplicial building blocks of synthesis of dimension I. Again, I'm trying. Someone is sending a signal to me. If you, so in four dimensions, the top dimension would be the N4. That would just count the number of four synthesis that make up the discrete volume. Now, that is important to understand the form of the bare Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action you would put into the theory when you were doing trying to do Euclidean quantum gravity. So you have an action that depends on the bare inverse Newton constant and the bare cosmological constant, and it has the following form, a kappa, so inverse Newton, times n naught, the number of vertices in the calculation, and then a kappa 4 that is essentially identical with the cosmological constant times the 4 volume. So this is not terribly surprising, that the number of vertices turns out to basically quantify the scalar curve, integrate the scalar curvature of the thing is also, one can immediately derive. But of course, it has a very, very simple structure, you see, as a function of some global counting variables of manifold. So that certainly makes it very, very easy to evaluate for any given discretized geometry what is Einstein, the weight of the Einstein Hilbert actually is. Now, if we look at this system, I should say one always, this is how these models work, one always tunes them already to the critical value of the bare cosmological constant that turns out to be tantamount to taking the infinite n limit. And what is then left over in the Euclidean case is just a single bare coupling, which is this kappa, the inverse Newton constant. Now, what one does find are two totally different phases of this as a statistical system. One is called the crumpled phase, the other one is called the branched polymer phase. And both of these have geometries that are just completely and utterly sick. Now, by geometry, I mean the superposition of geometries, so properties. I'm talking now about properties of the superpositions that come out from these constructions in the sense of the past integral and the Feynman idea of having them all superposed. So in the quantum phase, all your little triangles, no matter how many you're putting in, they're crowding around a small number, one, two of vertices. So everyone wants to share that single one vertex. And what does it mean? Even if I pump more and more volume into the system, they will never grow beyond the cutoff length. So where does the growth go? It does grow into generating higher dimensions. Of course, beloved by some of us, but it's so many dimensions, I can tell you, you cannot really use them for anything very much. So that's, for you, the crumple phase. Now, by contrast, you have the branch polymer phase, where all your lovely four-dimensional building blocks, unfortunately, align themselves into long polymeric structure. So locally, these things would still be four-dimensional, but when you step out, I mean, look at them from a larger scale, they would just behave like actually two-dimensional objects. Why not one-dimensional? Well, they can branch in any
point in any direction, so that it counts for the one-dimensional, in the house of dimension equal to two. These two phases turn out to be separated by first order transition, so there is really very little scope for finding an interesting continuum limit here. Now, that's of course a picture I'm putting to you, you know, with hindsight, and also now that we have understood the structure, of course it looks all, you know, rather neat and obvious. Now, if I do now the same thing for the Lorentzian symmetry, well, I told you I also have to recrotate, so I have actually, I'm working with a Euclideanized geometry, with Euclideanized to what Einstein actually. But of course, one ingredient already now is different, because as I showed you, when I showed you the Minkowskian 4D building block, I said, well, I still have a free scaling parameter, because now I have introduced an explicit anisotropy. So this little delta parameter I have here, that is a remnant, or it's one way of encoding this asymmetry. So it's still part of my parameters, and I'm still interested a priori in how my entire system and its continuum limit might depend on this. That is something certainly I want to look into, apart from the dependence on the inverse cosmological, the inverse of Newton laws. So you see now, if I write down explicitly the action in terms of these variables, now a certain sensitivity to the time versus space direction comes in. So there are now two types, say, of force indices to start with, depending on how they are oriented with respect to the space-time split. And this is how they appear in the action. Now, we've been studying the phase diagrams, and what I told you earlier about kind of the nice extended geometries that appear there, this only pertains to one of the phases in the phase diagram, which I call your phase C. There are also two other phases, depending on where you are in the coupling constant space, spanned by this asymmetry parameter capital delta, and your inverse Newton constant. So these phases, one can identify kind of as Lorentzian implementations of these two schooling phases I found here. So the closest one can get with the kinematical constraints that have imposed on these Lorentzian distributions to these crumpled and bar polynomial phases. So they have remnants of those, but very luckily another phase appears, which is where interesting physics is. And I won't be saying very much more about this particular phase diagram, but Jan Arnbjorn, certainly in his talk of Sunday, will tell you much more about this and also about possible new ideas we have because we've started to look again in more detail at this phase diagram than we did in the old days. So there might be some interesting structures hiding out there which we haven't thought about.
Good point. Is it from your feature book? Or is it just that was just.
Well, I'm not sure we want to nail ourselves down whether it's as a negative delta. Don't take it as too significant for now, for the time now. I mean, that has moved in new measurements we've been making. It always used to be above it.
In old days, we didn't measure the phase diagram in detail, but now we have done it, and this is what it looked like. I'll tell about it.
So let me just summarize the lessons I want to draw from this. Is here, first of all, causality is not emerging, but seemingly needs to be put in at the kind of most fundamental level, which we here could do very explicitly in the GUI rules of this triangulated models. Also, time is therefore is not emergent. So what I'm saying here, I call this, we need to put in the potentiality of time. What do I mean by this? Well, we have this time space diagram, so we had to put in a slicing. But of course, it was a priori unclear what would remain, what would become of the slicing in any continuum limit. So certainly, in this space here, where actually it turns out that all the space time just zooms to a thin slice with no time extension whatsoever, you would say, well, you put in the potentiality of time, but it's not realized in actual life, because, well, in order to have something, say, measurable time is, you need some kind of spatial extension. Otherwise, what sense does it make? So that's what I meant by potentiality of time. And it's not being realized here. Here you find a kind of oscillating, violently oscillating dynamics of three geometry, which also you cannot associate with anything interesting of a 4D structure. So you've put in this time, and, well, if you look at the correct or the nice space in the space diagram, you found actually something where this then turns into a physical time of a globally four-dimensional space, which is something very nice to say. Now, moving to key achievement number two, well, I'm limiting myself just to two, you know, in view of the time restriction, which is, well, also I think key and very important is this dynamical emergence of space-time as we know it from this very simple superposition of nothing much but quantum expectations that it defines. Now, as I said before, how precisely does this happen? Well, we don't know for sure. There is a check here, which you should remove. Now, what we can say for certain is that it's very essentially, it's essentially non-perturbative. So it's an entropic mechanism. What do I mean by that? It really has to do with how many geometries of a certain type contribute at a certain value of e to the is or e to the minus s. Yes. And it's something that you would have a hard time seeing any non-perturbative approach where you don't look at this entropic part, because that's a non-trivial measure that this method gives you. So magically, this is how we kind of rephrase our ignorance of precisely how this happens. These many microscopic building blocks, they arrange themselves in this quantum superposition in a nice way to produce an extended form of space-time, whose macroscopic shape, moreover, is that of a well-known cosmological solution to the classical Einstein equation. And how do we tell that? Well, one thing we can relatively easily study is the shape of the universe. What do I mean by the shape? I mean its three volume, as a function of this proper time that is sitting as part of our construction. So, and here you see this well-worn snapshot, Monte Carlo snapshot, of the volume profile of the four-dimensional dynamically generated quantum universe. Time is going this way, and all you see plotted here is just the three volume as a function of time. So don't pay attention to these little squares. They are just mathematically generated. So the actual information is just in this curve, which gives you this v-volume as a function of time. Now, this is a snapshot of what we do in the path integral evaluation. We look at this as a quantum observable. So, of course, we take the ensemble average over all these shapes. And then we look what comes out. So we look at the statistics of those, and quite marvelously, the spatial volume profile, V3 of T, as an expectation value in the ensemble you're looking at, turns out to match very, very accurately that of a classical super universe. Now, just showing you very briefly, or first saying a little more about the super universe, if it needs any further commenting on, that's of course a solution to the Einstein equation in the presence of a positive cosmological constant also. So one particular form of dark energy. If you look classically at the volume profile of Lorentzian de Sitter, so in the correct signature, in proper time, what you find is something that up to
there's some proportionality constant, is cos cubed of proper time, tau. And of course, usually we consider this for a positive tau, and of course, it gives you back the exponentially expanding universe. Now, of course, you have to keep in mind that when we measure this, of course, we're doing it in Euclidean time, because I told you we reciprocate. So the volume profile we expect to find, if we were lucky, is that profile is a tau substituted by I tau, namely kind of Euclidean time. And very beautifully, this is exactly what we see in the simulations. So here are the shapes. This the statistics of shape. So what is the outcome of that for the quantum average? It's this green dotted curve here. So here we have proper time. We have taken average over the data in such a way that we align them at the center of volume, if you like. And that produces this beautiful curve here, which can be fitted very, very accurately to a cosine cubed. And this is, of course, exactly Euclidean visitor space. And the analytic curve, you can barely distinguish from the curve you're measuring there. These red things are not error bars, but they quantify the size of the quantum fluctuations around this classical solution. So that's something we also measured and analyzed in somewhat more detail. And it turns out that even these quantum fluctuations can be rather well matched to a classical mini superspace calculation. Quadratic approximation around the visitor space. So again, that's kind of very beautiful. And what is also nice, I should mention in passing, of course, that we started with objects that were just highly quantum fluctuating. We didn't put in any assumption about isotropy or homogeneity, but still, we get out this very nice solution. So this is our self-organizing universe. Just going back to the previous slide, just one more comment, which I haven't said anything about so far. In order to simulate the system with a Monte Carlo method from a computer, of course, you have to choose boundary conditions. And as part of the boundary conditions, you have to choose, you have to fix the space-time topology of these Euclidean space-time. And what we've always been doing is we have chosen our slices and compact, well, that was a necessity for the simulations. You cannot have unbounded in the spatial directions. And they have chosen them to be S3s. And, well, to start with, the time extension, you just made an open interval. But very often, when you're just interested in kind of global results, where we don't expect the boundary conditions to matter too much, we actually we identify time cyclically. So the actual topology we have been using to produce this result is S1 cos S3. But of course, what I've shown you, you know, the snapshot of the universe, I've matched it to an S4. Well, it's very interesting because although you might have thought that you're introducing a bias explicitly by fixing the space-time topology to start with, it turns out that the system dynamically finds the actual topology. It goes as close to this S4 topology as is allowed by our kinematical kind of setup. And as I told you, it's very beautifully matched in S4. Okay, so therefore, here we go to the second set of lessons before I'm wrapping up. First is, if you now look at a kind of fully non-perturbative approach, that's what we've been doing. Of course, you wonder, now, what new things does that give you? And as I claimed before, it gives you kind of access to features of the system which would have been very difficult to see otherwise. For example, the fact that topology and dimensionality become dynamical is very, very explicit in this part of the approach. We saw it happen, you know, under our own eyes. We saw it at work with kind of excluding the Euclidean version of that as physical. By looking at the Hausdorff dimension, we see it again in finding interesting structures when evaluating a diffusion process on the ensemble on these geometries and deriving, extracting from it a spectral dimension, which I mentioned very early on in my talk. It's a nice observable, in inverted commas, for this type of system. And of course, since has been measured and determined in other approaches. Now, topology, as I just mentioned to you with the S4, also becomes, to an extent, dynamical. So what enables all these things to happen is the fact that in your path integral, you've allowed very strong fluctuations on very short scales. So on the shorter scales, always allowed by the cutoff. So the curvature would be very violent in all of these path integral histories that contribute to give this sum. It's very, very large on the smaller scales you're allowing. So if you let A go to zero, it's totally dominated on very short scales by absolutely crazy and non-classical and divergent, as a matter of fact, values for the local curvature. So this is what these things look like on short scales. On large scales, however, magically, they still gave rise to interesting, to beautiful, kind of classical looking geometry, as far as we can tell. So we can definitely also study the short scale fluctuations, but we'll not say much more about this now. And maybe only to highlight another non-perturbative lesson, which we also see here at work, is namely that the contribution from kind of these microscopes, if you like, or the quantum fluctuation that are excited in this type of theory, where you're really integrating over all these local degrees of freedom, they do contribute very crucially to the dynamics on large scales. And they do actually contribute very significantly to getting this specific space result. Because although, you see, if you look at a truncated kind of quantum cosmology, and you look simply at what the action is, if you write down everything just as an effective dynamic of the scale factor, what you find, of course, is a well-known result that it's unbounded below. Because the global scale factor, I'm calling it A, such a linear size of the universe at a certain time, of course, enters with this sick minus sign. So it just contributes, it creates an unboundedness in the action. However, what we find is that this gets regularized, in a way, not regularized, but it gets counteracted by the effect of the sum over a local excitation to lead to an effective effective action that underlies the decipher space we're seeing, which has an overall a plus sign in this degrees, in this kind of truncated mini superspace action. Okay, well, that basically ends what I'm going to say about the CDT and why it is such a nice thing today. For those of you who didn't know, I want to flash at least in this one slide what you're currently looking at, so what's new and what you may expect in the short to medium future to hear from us about. Is first of all, as was already mentioned in the discussion, we are currently having a closer look at the phase diagram. So we're really looking close to the transition line and trying to establish with certainty of what order they are. So that's still an issue of dispute. Which you also will hear something about in your numbers talk. Another little thing, which I, is a two-dimensional excursion, which might appear a little schizophrenic, where we are actually allowing causality violating points, and in this way allow also space-time to branch and split. And, well, it turns out you can control that to some extent, despite that not being terribly well motivated in a project called it's causal. And this is, was a whole bunch of papers where we therefore defined a string field theory based on CDT in zero target. It's very curious, and you can go and read about this in a whole bunch of papers. Now, I emphasized earlier on the need to define observables. Now, the very few observables we have are these dynamical dimensions. In the first place, it's very much a spectral dimension. Of course, you want to go further than that. Now, of course, we've been making efforts on this. This is hard. And of course, we all know it's hard, but it's hard independent of the approach to quantum gravity you're choosing. But let me just mention two instances where we are looking at this currently and what one might do and where one might see physical signatures. So one thing we've been doing is to put a point mass into these de Sitter spaces, in these ensembles, and trying to establish analytically, if you like, with pen and paper methods, what one expects to see, how one expects the volume profile to change as you then let the mass, you know, range over some scale of this additional part of it there. It can to some extent be done. It's actually, it meets a number of, not just computational, but issues of principle that we have to address. What we find is there is an effect, but it's tiny. And we're not sure we'll actually be able to spot it in the computer simulations. What? Yeah, no. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So it's something we have already in the computer simulation, but we don't have a corresponding analytical calculation, which would be desirable to extend this analogy of the sitter, what is a mini superspace, what we see on the computer. And now, can we extend that? That was the question behind this generalization. The second thing we've been looking at is to think of CDT as a kind of a reality check on results that people have been deriving in quantum cosmology. And of course, we all know that is afflicted with just with a zillion of ambiguities of all kinds. Now, the question is, if we claim to have a nice, you know, full quantum gravity picture, and we might be able to look at some cosmological properties of our space-time, can we nail down some of these ambiguities? And well, what do we expect? So what, together with Rachel Mitra, who's a postdoc at Utrecht, for instance, we've been looking into possible effects that are due to factor ordering ambiguities and how they might translate to measurable effects on our quantum universes. And again, this is not finished as a work, but indications are, again, we would see an effect, but it might be very, very tiny. So again, it's unsure whether within the computer accuracy we would actually be able to see. I think this is entirely typical, not just for us. And of course, as a not to leave out interesting things that have been done here, let me last but not least mention works that have been done by Dario Benedetti and Johansson, just recently a beautiful analysis of the spectral geometry in three-dimensional possibilities. And you should, of course, harass them in the coffee break on what precisely they're saying there. Okay, by way of summarizing my talk, the essential points I wanted to get across here today were, firstly, that with this method of causal dynamical triangulations and the associated toolbox, we really have an experimental lab. So a non-perturbative calculation handle on near Planckian or Planckian physics that is difficult to access possibly with other methods. And in that respect, it's of course rather similar to left-hand space. I showed you a bunch of what I believe are quite exciting results, and also new non-perturbative insights, which are of a geometric nature just by virtue of our formulation being very geometric in the first place. It relies on very few ingredients and fundamental principles. So if I try to compare this to other approaches of quantum gravity that are around, so I believe we are not quite as minimalistic, as Spartan, as a causal set people. Maybe just about on the level of FRG gravity applications. I think we have fewer something than loop quantum gravity and we're dot. Now, so.
As an unspecified series of. Now, I would say from what I've shown you today in the 1 hour I had available, is I have you'll give some kind of evidence that one that give rise to the hopes that one might, that if there is something like this unique theory of quantum gravity and which we can find the standard QFT methods, then our CDT group should be able to see it in some way. Beyond that, I would also want to point out that CDT can certainly be used to test non-perturbative predictions that come from other fundamental and totally unspecified theories that contain gravity. Because simply the degrees of freedom near the Planck scale, as long as they can be described as some kind of effective theory of gravity, we will be seeing also in our previous simulations. Now, to learn more about this exciting subject and the conclusions and the ongoing research, I recommend you very strongly to go to Jan Ambion's talks. I think he has actually two talks on Sunday, or otherwise to read our reviews or talk to me while I'm still here until Sunday. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes. mentioned that it's important to check that the results still depend on the microscopic realizations in the Little Triangles. So doesn't that automatically mean that you need an underlying fixed point structure when you change, say, the lattice spacing?
I don't know. That's, of course, a standard picture in universality. And we apply the standard logic, right, behind critical systems. So I rely on this. My proviso at the beginning of the talk was to say, well, of course, we're using this, but how far can we actually trust it, you know, to get things at the Planck scale where we don't believe anymore that we have a nice, smooth background space time? Can we really trust it? So it was a self-criticism in a way. But what does this method still do? Yes, I agree. And that was really the standard way of thinking about it. And that might be at play here. And it might just work, you know, just blindly closing your eyes to the fact that one is tampering with space and geometry itself. Yeah, still, it might give you kind of all the relevant information you need as you do. If you can nail down that among Gaussian fixed
points. Couldn't you nail down these fixed point properties on the level of your bare action? The way the planet is transformed?
I don't. Well, we need to go, I mean, an essential obstacle or difficulty for why, you know, I haven't been saying, well, we definitely can turn there is a fixed point or not, is the fact that we cannot penetrate, go as close to the Planck scale as we want to. And certainly, Jan will address it in his talks on Sunday. He's already raising a hand for comment.
Yes. For systems where entropy plays an important role, you have the action and you have the entropy as many statistical systems. When the fixed point is a combination of these two things, you can, of course, not just from the bare action, can deduce any properties. So that seems to be the problem.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
Are there any nice questions? What is the justification of the weights you use for the triangulation, like this automorphism factor? Is there any other reasonable justification? Because Einstein doesn't tell you.
It's true. Ultimately not. This is very simple. It's very natural in this setting. Basically, all distinct geometries come with weight one. Just if they happen to have accidental symmetries, then we divide out with a symmetry. Which, as I said, it does reflect, it does capture an aspect of the Wheeler-DeWitt measure. Ultimately, you don't know. However, you know that also there, you're covered to quite some degree by universality. So in Euclidean dynamical triangulations, where people in 4D didn't find the desired result, of course, one thing they tried to do is to tamper with the measure. Okay, so you can dream up all kinds of local factors that, for instance, depend on the coordination, local coordination number, put these in with a factor of 10, 20, 100, and see how your results change on the way. And there is very little sensitivity to this.
But you then call this a quantum fit theory. In a quantum fit theory, you found out graphs with a certain rules. It's not the case.
Well, the action is still there in the bare weight.
The action is in the weight,
in
but
the
not in
weight.
The way you found out the differential. There is no action. I was thinking
yeah.
to the in the group fit theory, of course, you have an action to found out the graphs. Or is it
I don't know what. Well, we claim to have something to do with gravity, so I think this is absolutely natural to have the Boltzmann wave. And then a democratic sum.
Yes.
If that doesn't look
yep.
in ultimately,
it's not the Boltzmann wave. Is
yeah.
It?
Ultimately, only the final result will tell you whether that was sensible or not. But there, what I'm saying is, you don't have so many choices, or we might. What might look like a different choice at the bare level might result in exactly an equivalent theory. So it's actually difficult to get away from particular. Yeah, it's difficult to get away from. I want to say from fixed point, of course, but we don't know whether there is such a thing. It's difficult to tamper with ingredients to get to a result that is inequivalent. But the causality requirement is exactly kind of a relevant parameter in this sense. But there are not so many of those. Like, you don't know any others.
And there's a reference to that?
Yeah, I have one question and one comment. The question is, can you measure somehow or probe for the number of propagating polarizations of the graviton in this simulation? Or how far are we from probing some local structure?
Very far. Very far still. I mean, of course, it's well, you want to understand, of course, for example, is the conformal mode propagating? I guess that's something that would interest you particularly. You would have to define some diffeo invariant observable that are sensitive to this. I don't know of any good suggestion what that might be, of something that is also then can be evaluated, I mean, reliably in our numerical setting. So these are two conditions that are difficult to satisfy. I'm not saying it's impossible, and I certainly haven't thought about it a little bit, but there is nothing obvious.
So I have my question.
You have the floor and I comment first.
I just wanted to address the issue of the fixed point. I, of course, love these results. I think they are beautiful and heroic, but I have a slightly different interpretation of whether it's the causal structure or the foliation structure. In my view, it doesn't depend whether you're looking at the imaginary time or the real-time formulation. You're putting in a preferred foliation structure in space-time, and that's the relevant thing that makes the continuum limit possible. And then the phase diagram, my interpretation of that conjecturally would be that the tricritical point that you see in the middle connecting these three phases should be a Lipschitz-type critical point with anisotropic scaling. So that would be at least a conjectural possible answer to the question of the existence of the fixed point. Maybe it scales anisotropically. And then as you flow, if you're up in the continuum limit of the diagram where you get a macroscopic four-dimensional isotropic space-time, that's the phase where you've flown from an isotropic scaling in the UV to the isotropic scaling in the infrared. But of course, those are conjectures that
we we have some preliminary comments on how this might, under certain circumstances, match part of your scenario. There's a comment, and the other comment was, again, that in this discretized scenario, it's, to my understanding, it's impossible to decouple the slicing from the causality.
Okay, this question is somehow related with this comment. You impose a causal slicing in your simulations, but if we consider the interior of a black hole, then the radial coordinate is time-like, and the time coordinate is time-like. So are you throwing away all these configurations in your simulations?
I certainly shouldn't hope so. Of course, you see, I mean, certain restrictions I put in here at the bare level, it's, we don't a priori know what becomes of them in the continuum limit.
Yes.
So one, of course, would hope that one would recover at least potentially all these singular configurations in some way, and that's perfectly possible because locally the structure is very, very singular, I mean, non-classical. So this is not, it's difficult to say anything about this a priori.
Yeah, but the slicing is exactly opposite.
Yeah. So yes, and now if I was looking, as we actually have been doing, at putting a heavy point particle in there, you're already facing the problem of how do you actually represent this? If it's very heavy and very small, of course, it will make a black hole. How does it intertwine with the slicing, or how do you implement it? And do you even see it? This is, of course, not just Lorentzian slice, but it's Euclideanized sliced. So, you know, the mass is not even there in your usual Euclidean black hole space, and it's simply not there. So when I was talking about the conceptual problems that arise when you look even at a single point particle coupled to this, this is one of the things I was referring to.
Well, so this refers maybe to a particular choice of coordinates, which...
No, I mean, just from...
Of course, if you
are...
Yeah,
it's but if you have an horizon, then that's something independent.
That was only one little point. Does the de Sitter group act in any non-trivial way on your emerging de Sitter background space time?
You mean I have a local coordinate description?
So that you can act on it somehow.
I would first have to reintroduce coordinates, and then doubtless, I think, yeah. If I could show that it's locally
that metric. I can't know this explicitly. I cannot.
No, but even in a
certainly.
No, no, but what I want to say, of course, there is also a coordinate independent way, and so in this space-time is a maximally symmetric space with a certain number of killing vectors and so on. So can you see these
but to what extent
aspect somehow?
You want to say how can I explicitly probe the local metric properties of this interspace? Am I interpreting you
wrong? No, I mean I'm asking you show this cost plot. Yeah.
Yes,
so,
yeah. That is of course but that has already of course metric information in it. Well, we have looked at other things apart from the volume. From the volume profile of the S4, for example, we have looked at the volume profile of the individual S3s that make up the S4.
Okay.
And also there you can reasonably metrically the volume profile to that of an S3. So you know we are reasonably confident that at least on large scales it is really something like around S4. When you've chosen an appropriate relative scaling, of course, of time and space. So
that's fine. So in your discretization, the symplices are the equilateral?
Yeah, you have two types of wavelengths. So to start with, you have, I've shown the timeline. Yes, they are essentially equilateral.
Because what troubles me is that, for instance, in two dimensions, if I just put equilateral triangles, I just get deficit angles, which are multiples of pi over 3.
Yes.
So isn't this a kind of restrictive, because there are metrics which have deficit angles, which are very far from pi over 3.
Yes. So it's certainly this type of approximation is not very good if you wanted to, say, simulate the classical Einstein equations, because these geometries don't in any way kind of converge point-wise in a nice way to smooth objects. But that is not a consideration that a priori is relevant here. I mean, what we are here approximating is a space of all geometries. And certainly, when you do this in 2D, I mean, also Euclidean, these are both results. So really what you get from this discretized picture with the dynamical time relations as a continuous theory is essentially the same you get from a gauge fixed, perfectly bona fide, you know, pass integral description. So that gives you, of course, that reassures you that in principle can work. Although these are not classically good approximations, as you pointed out.
I just have a very simple question. How could you give us maybe you said it? How close? I mean, how small is your discrete unit?
Yes, I haven't said that. Okay. Once you've taken the continued limit. And you look at certain observables that have to do again with the shape, certain correlators that have to do with these volume shapes, then we can actually fix the dimensional transmutation. So we can associate with these dimensionless lattice units physical length units. And it turns out, I mean, for the measurements we've been making, they are in a certain region of the space frame I showed you. So lattice spacing, a few lattice spacings, one lattice spacing is a few Planck lengths.
Or one lattice spacing is a few Planck.
It's a few Planck lengths. So we're not yet at a stage where we are probing structures that are below the Planck lengths. And that's something we'd like to be able to do by moving around appropriately in our phase space.
One last question.
Is there a way to characterize the time that you have in your, because you have a preferred foliation, you have a preferred time. Can you match it with something like York time or something that is known classically?
Yes. So if I look at it at the level of this interspace we found, it really seems to coincide on large scales with cosmological time, proper time.
Okay.
So that's a nice match. Well, again, you cannot necessarily anticipate from what you put in at the discretized level, but the match
this match was underlying the fitting to the S4, identifying this with a global cosmological time.
Talking about time, I think we have eaten up all the discussion time. I think it's better we go to eat some proper food.